One of the things we've been doing, if you're visiting with us, has been camping on Romans 1, 16 and 17. It is a verse that simply says, I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation to all who believe, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it, or in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. For it is written, the righteous man or the righteous person shall live by their faith. And that verse 17 is a quote from Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 4, where Habakkuk is in, it's kind of God's response in a nutshell to the mess that Habakkuk looks at. And if you haven't been with us, let me just overview it briefly. Habakkuk is a prophet, but he is not speaking on God's behalf to the people. He's speaking on God or the people's behalf to God. And he's struggling with four critical issues. He is struggling with the issue that sometimes God doesn't answer. And he's really struggling with how to figure that out, especially in light of the fact that, secondly, there's tremendous moral evil that's going on around him, especially with God's people. The bad behavior of God's people, he's really struggling with, and God doesn't seem to be answering or responding to it. The other part of this is not only the moral evil that's going on, but also the injustices are going on. There seems to be people who are exploiting others and taking advantage of them. They use people just for personal gain. And we went through chapter 2 and looked at five different critical ways that there was injustices touching the life of Israel or Judah at this particular time. But the other aspect of this was that God promised that he was going to bring the ungodly Chaldeans over to discipline his own people because his people had forsaken their covenant with God and now had been living like the rest of the nations. And God had promised that if you do this, I will discipline you. And if you will not respond to my compassion, I at some point will exile you out of the promised land so that the land can have its rest and so that we can, God can fulfill or try to draw his people back to himself. Now, so this series has been a lot of tough questions. All the question marks you've seen out in the foyer have been built around that whole idea that we're asking tough questions. Now, this morning, I'm going to change gears slightly. What we're going to do is look at one of those tough questions that tends to be part of our culture, not necessarily evoked directly from the text, but I want to propose to you that there is elements of it, and it really deals with what I'm calling the invisible afflictions of the mind. In other circles, you might call them mental illness. But one of the things that we often deal with, and all of us to some degree, is these invisible afflictions of the mind. There's a lot of stereotype that goes with that and around in our circles. For instance, as we think about this, one is it hasn't always been okay to talk about mental illness or the invisible afflictions of the mind. I'll explain to you in a minute why I'm using both those titles. It is easy to include a lot of different things in it. I believe that depression becomes one of those indications of those afflictions of the mind that does happen to have a medical diagnosis or tag to it, but lots of us go through depression in life, never gets medically treated, we use our friends to counsel us through it, and yet it's an affliction that plagues our heart and mind, brings tremendous stress, at times we feel profoundly overwhelmed with life, and we struggle with finding hope in the midst of it. And I believe not only is there a spiritual battle going on, but these afflictions sometimes are temporary in our life and sometimes they are, well, more driven by biology and genetics and other things that we have very little control over. As we begin to think about this, one of the great challenges is that we want to talk about is to remove the stigma in our context of church that these people are not welcome. And I've been in churches where both things have happened. We've seen people reach out with tremendous grace and compassion and move alongside people who have certain mental illnesses or afflictions that are not temporary, but more things that they deal with on a regular basis. And I've seen it work badly, where people are basically at times uninvited to participate because they don't know how to control their behavior in community or social environments, and it becomes very disruptive and destructive. And so that becomes, seems like a no-option kind of scenario for us as believers where we say, listen, you just can't be here if you cannot figure out how to interact with us. The problem with that is just telling someone to do that doesn't fix anything. One of the greatest problems and ignorances that we have is that we just tell people, look, smarten up, act better, make better choices, and everything will be fine, and that's not always necessarily the truth. Let me give you just a couple of things to note before we tell you some stories. Depression is the leading cause of disability worldwide. 2012, there were an estimated 9.6 billion adults 18 or older with serious mental illness. An estimated 40.3 million adults 18 and older in the U.S. in the past year were experiencing some kind of mental illness or affliction. And one of four adults suffer from one form of mental illness or another. If you look at the National Institute for Mental Illness, these are some of the things that get labeled. Anxiety disorders, attention deficit, hyperactivity disorder, autism, bipolar disorder, borderline personality disorder, and depression. There are others that are part of a larger category: eating disorders, panic disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, schizophrenia, and social phobias. And the problem is how do we learn, if I want to borrow the phrase from Romans 1, 16 and 17, is how does individuals learn how to live by faith and to live righteously in the midst of these afflictions? And the other larger question is, how do we as a community of faith learn to live by faith, to learn to live righteously and compassionately in the midst of others that have more serious mental afflictions, as it were, than we would? Now, having said that, let me also say that I think spiritually we all have mental afflictions. Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 3 talks about that if you look into the hearts of human beings, there's evil and insanity indwells their hearts. And I think because of the curse of the fall, that we all have a sense of invisible afflictions that affect our mind. In fact, that's why Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 says, trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. Now, one of the things that I may forget to say later, so I'm going to mention it now, is that I was listening to a TED Talk by Ruby Wax, who isn't a Christian, so I'm not agreeing with everything she said. But one of the things she said that really resonated with me is that she said, in not these exact words, but every illness or affliction of the body tends to provoke tremendous sympathy and compassion and from the rest of the body, except for afflictions of the mind. Somehow when we have these afflictions of the mind, we just think people ought to snap out of it. How to make better choices. Just fix it. And it's almost like we have this sort of spiritually myopic view, and here's the way you usually hear it, is that, well, we know we can't trust emotions because they're affected by the fall and they can get entangled in things, but you have to pull yourself out of your emotions and use common sense and use your head. And I will challenge us that one of the things that we have to understand is that our brains and our way of thinking have been affected by the fall as much as anything else that we would experience, whether it's emotions, our body, or any other kind of illness. I think sometimes we get this idea that the only thing that's spiritually protected and that we can rely on is our common sense and our thoughts and our mind. And I disagree with that. I think it's as broken as our emotions are. I think it's as broken as our body is. I think it's as broken as our culture is. And so we all are in a process of healing when we learn about God's truth, learn how to trust that and not our own way of thinking. Then we learn how to find healing in our own journey and find new life and live how to live righteousness. Now, you can tell this affects the Christian community. And you might say it's differently, but you don't have to have a medical disorder to have the afflictions of the mind because of the divorce rate that's gone up. To the broken families that are Christians, you can tell that there are afflictions of people's life and mind and heart that are devastating because it has clearly affected our families. To go back to Habakkuk chapter 1 and 2, I think I'm going to take a shot in the dark, and I'm going to think if you read this at all or have been here for any of this journey, you will discover that Habakkuk is under a little bit of stress. And I think he has some spiritual, theological, emotional, and mental afflictions because he can't reconcile a good God who doesn't answer in the midst of moral evil and all this other junk that's going on. And so I think he's slightly stressed. In fact, when you get to the end of chapter 1 and he says, all right, God, I'm tired of this. I'm going to camp up on this rampart. I expect an answer and I'm not moving till you give it to me. Tells me if he wants to take on God, he's got to be over the edge a little bit. Now, what I want to do this morning is rather than preach through stuff, we want to sort of preach the message a little bit differently. I want you to hear some stories about how this journey has gone. Now, the reason I'm going to be emotional this morning is I'm going to try to tell you a story of our own family and how we have gone through a journey that we've never told publicly, but is very real to where we're at. So my wife decided to stay downstairs, which is probably wise on her part, because she goes, I will never get through it. I said, good luck now. I'm the only one that won't get through it. But anyway, but before we go there, I want to invite Ann Bolsom up. And I want to just interact with her a little bit on this to talk about their story. Thanks, Ann. Now, I have a lot of respect for Bolsoms. I have a lot of respect for my daughter. I think this is a journey and things that we need to talk about and need to have the courage not to gossip, but to talk with people about this process and what's going on. So Anne has agreed on behalf of their family for me to just do a little interview thing for a few minutes here to talk a little bit about the challenges they've had, and then I'm going to try to tell our story in terms of where we've been. So Anne, I'll just let you kind of introduce things to you, and I'm going to stick pretty stringently to the questions here so that we stay on task. But what are the invisible afflictions that your family, of the mind that your family has had to tackle and work through?
Well, many of you know that we have two wonderful action boys that we love dearly. And as we've grown to raise them, have come to learn that they both struggle with mental, non-neurotypical disabilities. Our oldest son, Eli, was diagnosed at age 7 with autism, and our younger son, Barrett, has been diagnosed with ADHD. That's a really potent combination to have in a family because you have one child who is very rule-bound and rigid and inflexible, and another child that is very impulsive, and that causes a lot of conflict. Along the journey, both Brad and I have also struggled with anxiety and depression. And so as a family, we have to work very hard to accept each other as we are and learn how to not expect people to be who we think they should be. Rather than expecting our child to be this child that we want him to be, we have to be accepting of that he's the child God made him to be, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's not a disease. It's not an illness. It's who God made him to be. His mind works different than ours, and in many regards, his mind is amazing compared to ours because he looks at life completely differently than we do. So that's kind of the journey that we have been on for the last 5 or 6 years, and along the way, there have been a lot of emotional roller coasters as we learn how to best parent children that are not your neurotypical children.
So you kind of hinted at it there, but what would you verbalize as the challenges and fears that you guys have had to face in kind of looking at this?
One of the most challenging things about a child with autism is that developmentally, in some areas, he's completely normal or mature or has the skills that are expected of a child at that age, but there are lots of gaps and lots of holes in the development. When we first learned of the diagnosis, the doctors kind of explained it as the way his brain is wired. It's almost like Swiss cheese, where there are holes where you would expect development to be. It's not there. So one of the biggest areas of underdevelopment is that in social and emotional areas. When Eli is struggling with emotions, it's very challenging. He struggles with identifying how he's feeling or why he's feeling that way, and struggles with having an appropriate response to that. So a 12-year-old body with a 2-year-old response to an emotional situation is very challenging, because you think you're 12, you're very bright, you're very mature. Why are you acting this way? But it's because that's the way his brain is wired.
So as you're thinking about just challenges to your faith in general, is it, you know, what's the Habakkuk experiences that you've had to kind of work through as a family and as a couple?
Every day is a new journey and is a new challenge, and you never know what you're going to expect. And on the good days, when we're walking by faith and I feel filled with the Spirit, we have the grace and the patience to accept him where he's at and to parent him the way that he needs to be parented. On the days when we're empty and Satan has gotten hold, it's very hard to be the parent that he needs us to be. And it's exhausting. If this had been something we experienced earlier on in our marriage, fortunately, we've been married for almost 22 years. If this is something we had experienced at 10 years into our marriage, it would have definitely taken a toll on our relationship. But at this point, we've realized that even the hardest days together are better than any day apart. And so it really takes a team between the two of us to work together, take turns shouldering the burden and supporting each other.
So as you think about, you know, your own journey and faith and so on and so forth, what do other people do that's helpful, and what do people do that's maybe not so helpful in this journey?
People who are understanding and non-judgmental are amazing. One of the hardest things that people will say is, oh, well, he doesn't look autistic, or, oh, it doesn't look like he has any problems, or, oh, he's doing so well. You're right. He doesn't look autistic because he looks like a normal kid. That's what makes autism great, is that they look like normal kids, that they're just everyday kids. And yep, he's doing great right now in this moment at this very time, place. But he's holding it together now, which means when we get home later today or tomorrow, when he's tired or when he's reached his point of not being able to stay focused and manage his emotions and manage the sensory input, then we have meltdowns. And those meltdowns are really difficult, because you think he was doing so well. He held it together. But that's what struggle is. The struggle is real. The struggle is that when he looks like he's got it together, he does, but it's only for short times. And recognizing that we aren't here every Sunday, because we can't be here every Sunday. We want to be here. We want to be at the birthday parties. We want to be at all of the events and special activities, but it doesn't happen because it's too much for him, for us, for the whole family to be able to participate. So having that understanding that when we say no, it's not because we don't want to. It's because it's what is best for our family. And just understanding that if we're having a difficult day, anything that people can do to show compassion and grace and understanding to help alleviate some of the responsibilities and difficulties is so appreciated.
Because along with that, I think one of the challenges would be, it's better for them to know the invisible afflictions of other people or not? I would think from a child's perspective, people could get very frustrated with them, because if they don't know what they're dealing with, they can get extremely frustrated with them because they're not acting like the rest of the kids, or they're acting badly. Mm-hmm. What you're sharing today, so this obviously, that I assume is, and I appreciate you doing this very much. So what's been the greater tension, sharing with people what's going on or not sharing with people and trying to treat everything as normal?
I used to want to treat everything as normal, and then God woke me up and told me, hey, you know what? You need help. You can't do this alone, so you don't need to pretend like everything's normal, because what is normal? There is no normal. Everyone has their issues. So I feel like in order to advocate for my son and for our family and for other people to see that, hey, it's okay, to be supportive of other families, to say, it's okay, we are all in this together. I'm not embarrassed. He is who God made him to be. God put him in our life for a reason and a purpose. And so I'm at this point trying to teach Eli how to be an advocate for himself, how to not be embarrassed about what he struggles with, and to speak up and say, I need help. I have autism. I can't do this. I need a break. To be able to express those things on his own so he doesn't have to depend on us to do that for him all the time.
And just maybe two more questions. Are there stereotypes or things that you get labeled with or that you worry about either as parents or as a family that you feel like you have to always overcome, or is that not really that important in terms of how you navigate through life?
I think it's interesting how autism is a really unique disability, because every person with autism is 100% different. There's a quote that says, if you've seen one person with autism, you've seen one person with autism, because it's a spectrum disorder, so every person is different. So I think having that understanding that everyone is different and unique with it helps a lot. What worked for some kids doesn't work for other kids. Every child with it is individual and unique. That's kind of the biggest piece with that.
So you've mentioned a couple of things like compassion and understanding. What, as a community of faith, what do you think are a couple of things, maybe in addition to that, and if nothing else, then that's fine, but that we have to keep learning how to do in terms of moving alongside families?
I think one thing is to just be aware of all of the different possibilities of issues that kids might have. So when we're setting up events or activities, being aware, providing opportunities for parents, maybe having some support groups where families can come and feel safe to express and communicate what they're going through. It's a very lonely journey, because you feel like no one else knows what you're going through. And when you can get connected with other people that can say, yep, been there, I get that, there's just that support. But even knowing that having an escape or having a support for if we have VBS, knowing that we might have kids that need less stimulation, that they need a place to go, having events at different times or shorter times, just really being aware of the needs of our kids and their families so that they don't have to not participate.
All right. Anything else you want to share that we didn't talk about that would be valuable in understanding your family's journey before I let you go sit down?
This church has been amazing. When we went through some serious struggles last winter and our son was being treated in some hospitalization programs for some emotional dysregulation, we felt the love and support of all of you, and that was incredible. It was the first time that I realized that I had to not only ask for help, but I had to be open to accepting help, which it's easy to ask, it's hard to accept it. But this community of believers was so loving and compassionate. We couldn't have walked that journey without the support of this church.
Well, Ann, thank you for really sharing. Why don't you give Ann a hand for sharing with us a little bit? I really appreciate it. Thanks, Ann. Yeah, I think that that one statement Ann made here at the end, all of them were really valuable, but clearly the idea is you can feel really alone in that journey. And some of it isn't other people's fault. No matter how much you want to understand, if you haven't gone through the same thing, you just can't connect on all the same pieces that what people are going through it. I'm going to try to share a little bit of our journey in terms of where we've been. I want to thank my daughter for giving me permission to share this story, because she's never shared it publicly. There's been few people that know it personally and privately. Just in case you can't figure it out, my daughter's the one that's on the right. My wife is the one on the left. Let me just give you a little background. We moved out here in 2009 to take on the lead pastor role here. Our daughter came with us. She was still a junior in high school. She finished her junior and senior highs here in Minneapolis. And right around her 18th birthday, she also contracted diabetes. Passed down. My wife has diabetes, as most of you know. My son actually contracted it when he was about 25. So three out of the four of us have diabetes that we need to deal with. When she went to school, her first term, she went to Trinity Western University up in Langley, British Columbia. There's no way to tell the whole story, obviously, but partway through one of her terms, we started getting phone calls from Barb's sisters who were saying they were somewhat concerned about Colleen because she didn't look healthy. It was hard for us to know what was going on, but the basic idea is that she was losing weight, and not just in a little amount, but more extreme. As we didn't know what that looked like till she came home for Christmas. And then we were quite alarmed when we saw her because it was shocking for us to see how much she had lost. It was, she's about 5'6", and at that time probably under 100 pounds. And it was really alarming to us. And we suddenly had kind of panicked a little bit in the sense of, wow, we've got to do something to rescue our daughter. And of course, we don't want to make it about us, but I'll just tell you from a parent's perspective, you start going, what did we do or what did we not do that led to this? And of course, that's not really the issue. We can easily get caught in that kind of myopic tunnel. But as Colleen will say in her own words, this is something she's had for a long time and it surfaced in different ways. I'm going to give you some quotes about some of the things that she said, just so that you can hear her heartbeat, and I really appreciate her sending some of these to us, but let me mention some things in the journey. She said at one point, she didn't even know that it was happening. It was so really such a slow process that she didn't even detect that things were changing in the way that she thought and looked at life. It was part of her insecurities, part of it was circumstances. And she said, the hardest thing about battling your own mind is that it is often rooted in thoughts and our ideas that you've always seemed to have. So it all seems normal. Her statement, the really ugly thoughts about yourself just feel normal. It took me a really long time to realize not everybody thought the way I did. The other thing she talks about is the power the mind has and how incredible this tool that God has given to us and how much it can affect us. She said, when I looked in a mirror, I literally could not see anything abnormal or different. Even with protruding bones and sunken skin, I was literally blind to the problem. So it was quite a shock when she came back and we could see those things, but we reacted very differently than what she did. We were just looking at life through a very different lens. So as we moved through this, we took her immediately to the doctor. The doctor immediately made her appointment with her over at Melrose, and we went over there. We thought it was an appointment. It really wasn't. They sat down with us and immediately said that we need to admit you. Well, that really created anxiety on a different level than you can imagine. She was home for Christmas. She had plans to be at Christmas, to go out with her friends, to hang out with family because she didn't get to see us very often. She had no plans or inkling to spend time in a hospital. And probably one of my most crucial memories was doing something that they never allow you to do over there, and that is she wanted to go outside and get a breath of fresh air and think about it. I told her, fine. They panicked. Because they said the moment someone walks out the door, we'd almost never see them again. So we sat out for an hour sitting out in the Concord area talking for about an hour, trying to not be dictatorial, but trying to persuade somebody who was old enough now to make whatever decision she wanted that this could be a life and death struggle, and this is really important to do no matter how much you want to spend time at Christmas with family and friends. She conceded, but we know this was going to be a real struggle for life. She says this: "It took me a few days in the hospital to actually recognize that something was wrong. It took a lot of counseling and people helping me understand that the things that I thought were not how everybody else was thinking. I wish I had words to describe what it's like to be stuck in your own mind. It's terrifying because once you get past seeing how destructive you are to yourself, you have to start battling it. The only way I can think of is to describe how I felt was truly to making the impossible happen. I knew what I was doing was not glorifying or healthy. The idea of stopping or letting go of it felt like trying to breathe underwater, literally that I might die if I stop. It scared me so bad that I couldn't even wrap my head around trying to eat differently than the way I was. Because for me, there was so much panic and anxiety that came with food. As soon as I stepped outside the basic foods I ate, it was like my brain went into flight mode. I couldn't think of anything else. I was overcome with guilt and paralyzed with anxiety. I asked her the question, what were the fears and challenges you had to face as you were thinking through this? And this is one of them. I can't share everything with you, obviously. This is a snapshot of a journey that we have been in for a while. But this is one of her comments. In the moments where you do have the courage to face up to it, you immediately start hearing all these lies about how terrible you are. It's inside her head. Or how people won't like you if you look different than you do now, or how fat you're going to be if you start eating normally again. And you believe it because that's how this eating disorder got there in the first place. You can't tell me that our brains and our minds aren't affected by the fall. It is not a sacred place where we have more spirituality than our emotions. There is a challenge that's not being chosen. It's part of the afflictions we have to deal with it. There's no way you can tell me, my daughter said, I want to choose this on her own. And as you think about this, there are so many different things, but let me try to suggest. When I asked her what was the process of learning to live by faith, this was her response. One of the biggest moments for me was reading a book about anxiety, and God and someone defined faith as not necessarily doing what you feel, but following God despite how you feel. It was easily the biggest turning point in recovery for me. For so long, I couldn't understand trying to get better when it felt so awful and so difficult. I realized the battles are tough and they don't feel nice all the time, but that's what it means to have faith, trusting God in the storms. That's why God's word and his promises are so critically important, because sometimes we can't trust our own thought processes. I'd asked what people did that were helpful and not helpful, and she gave a whole number of things. She said, the most frustrating with an eating disorder is when people focus too much on the symptom. You know, are you eating more? Because that is so superficial to the reality of what the issues are. Once you trust people to know what you're dealing with, battling your mind, I needed them to help me focus on deeper issues, like how I viewed myself and how I understand God's view of me. The worst thing was that when someone asked how my eating was, as I mentioned, to me it felt like they were thinking of this as an easy fix and downplayed the weight of what I was going through. This one's a little bit trickier and sometimes tougher, because sometimes you don't know who the bad guy is. Even when I was upset or felt misunderstood, though, having people stand by you is something I never took for granted. Some people in the hospital she's referring to never had visitors in the hospital at all. But she said, I never ever had a night where my parents or friends weren't by my side. We didn't do anything. We just hung out. We were just there. And I would like to pretend that aside from like Job's friends who came in and tried to tell him all the things that he was doing wrong and needed to fix, we just sat there and interacted about squirrels and gophers and her brother or whatever. She had girlfriends from school that showed up and hung out for most of the evening, just talking whatever. I wasn't there. I don't know. that there's something just about the presence of people that say, we haven't given up on you and we're here. And to avoid the stress of trying to fix somebody. Now, a couple of the things that I will suggest to you, and this is going to sound a little bit funny, but I want to mention it to you anyway, because we may not understand this, but this is, I think, very relevant to where Habakkuk is in terms of the message he gives there. It says this: it didn't take long into recovery for me to realize how grateful I was for my eating disorder. Sounds a little funny, doesn't it? Without it, I don't know how else I would have broken through so many insecurities and ways of thinking that I had literally had for my entire life. Sometimes it still baffles me that for so long I thought thinking so badly of myself was normal. I'm going to pause and take a very general shot in the dark to say that some of you are kind of like that too. It may not be to this extreme, but some of you have grown up either being criticized or ridiculed or mocked or whatever, and your self-tapes that go on over and over again say you're a worthless, valueless person, and it's an affliction of the mind that I think has a huge spiritual battle to it, where Satan wants to cripple you as a human being by turning your mind against you. God had to break me open like that so he could heal me. Now, I have a lot of respect for my daughter. She has courage and faith that I don't know about. Because when you're trapped by your own mind and you have to step so far out of what feels normal in order to find healing, it takes a remarkable sense of trusting God, because it literally feels like a blind leap of faith. But here's a comment, and I know these are long, and I apologize for that, but I want you to hear her heartbeat, not mine. Here is one of the most powerful statements that I think she makes. Trying to understand the power of salvation can also be a bit of a hurdle for me. When you've grown up hearing about God your whole life, it can lose a bit of its weight. But going through an eating disorder, I have never needed God so tangibly in my entire life. Only he could transform my heart and my mind. I have had absolutely no strength to do it, and no one else could do it for me. Out of everything, I think I'm most grateful for that. It has been the most beautiful gift of understanding his love for me, how hard he fought to bring my mind and heart back to him. See, her salvation wasn't just that God magically made it all go away. He brought healing through the journey. And the courage of trusting him when at times she didn't even have hope. And when I go back to the book of Habakkuk, if we took the time to read chapter 3, Habakkuk seems to have had such a radical change of perspective from chapter 1 to chapter 3 that you have to kind of wonder what on earth changed. And it wasn't the circumstances, it was his heart and mind. His salvation, as you would read through Habakkuk chapter 3, he's going to talk about, it's a big prayer. It starts with a prayer. And he really revisits the God who delivered Israel out of Egypt. He talks about plagues and other things that showed that in the most dire, darkest times of Israel's history, when they were enslaved to Egypt and there was no hope for generations, that God came down and out of his great compassion, he delivered his people from something they could never deliver themselves from. And he invites God to revitalize his work, which I believe involves both his compassion to keep pleading with his people to repent, and yet his faithfulness to bring the Chaldeans in to discipline his people because they'd abandoned the covenant relationship with God. And God was just being absolutely faithful to what he said he would do. And as you read through this, I hear my daughter's voice in these last verses. I heard and my inward parts trembled at the sound of my lips quivering. Decay enters my bones, and in my place I tremble, because I must wait quietly for the day of distress, for the people to arise who will invade us. It's a journey that he can't change. It's inevitable to happen. But then he says, though the fig tree should not blossom, and there be no fruit on the vines, though the yield of the olive should fail, and the fields produce no food, though the flock should be cut off from the fold, and there is no cattle in the stalls, yet I will exult in the Lord. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength, and he has made my feet like hinds' feet and makes me walk on my high places. And what I want to mention to you this morning is that where Habakkuk found his salvation was from despair and hopelessness to finding a shelter and a refuge in the shadow of his Savior. God would be absolutely faithful. But he found his salvation in trusting God, that even though he'd bring judgment on Judah, he was still the God that could trust and bring healing in his own life. You know, one of the things we have to keep learning is how to care for people who have afflictions of the mind, whether it's simply they're depressed and overwhelmed with life and greatly distressed, or whether they're schizophrenic or bipolar, whether there's other things that are part of this journey. We have to have the clarity and confidence that our God is greater than even the greatest afflictions that we face. One of the things that I thought was important is Habakkuk discovered that God was absolutely faithful to what he promised he would do. God's salvation would come through the process of pain and suffering. Salvation was not from the pain and suffering. I don't know where you're at this morning. I don't know what afflictions are causing your life to stress, to have anxiety, to give up hope. But whatever it is, I want to encourage you from personal experience that while it may take tremendous courage and faith to trust God in ways that we can never learn just with the easygoing life that we have here in this culture, he is there and he is faithful and he will hear. But as Anne so eloquently pointed, we got to do this together. This is part of what it means to be a healing community in the midst of a really broken world. And so I invite you, as we have the guys come and finish off our time together, that when you sing, make it a prayer. Don't just lip service songs. Make it the expression of your heart. And I want to say, I forgot to ask Anne before she came up, but I think it's fairly obvious by her sharing and testimony. We're happy to talk about our journey. We are happy to answer questions. We're happy to learn together what it means as those made righteous by the gospel of Jesus Christ, how to live by faith in the integrity of righteousness with great compassion and great mercy and great love for one another.